This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to Conversation Comics. I'm your host, Todd Weber. Conversation Comics is a show where we look at comic books in a very detailed fashion, at least this time around. And I am on part 8 of my series, along with my partner in this venture, Tim Capel. And we are looking at the Uncanny X-Men, Chris Claremont, and John Byrne run. We're knee-deep in the Dark Phoenix saga. Tim, bail me out here.
Todd, I am talking old-ass X-Men comics. I am talking to you, Todd Weber, so that I am in my happy place. Looking forward to getting into this. I can't, you know, we were talking before how this is just 8 episodes deep into this series, covering one run of comics, and I'm just kind of astonished how quickly we blew through those earlier issues, because at this point we're down to like an issue an episode, and these episodes are a healthy length, as we've discussed. Yes. Deservingly so, but it's just like, man, we started out just kind of rolling through these.
Yeah, I think, and we're 5 or 6 in a show.
Yeah, and we're to the stage here in our evolution of going panel by panel now. Literally
we are, and you know, we get mocked, but I think it works out. There's a lot to talk about here, especially with the baggage and the relationships that we have with our friends, the X-Men.
That's right. And that is what it feels like, you know, visiting old friends.
Yeah, it is. It's, this is the foster home I was part of when I was a young man. You know, you did have these characters all around with you. You had a lot fewer distractions back in the days. You know, you were reading things, and they would stay with you, and you'd have to wait a whole month, so you'd chew on that episode for a month. At least me, when I was reading some of the later runs coming out. This had already happened. This Dark Phoenix saga had already wrapped up by the time I started reading X-Men, and that was around, I think I started reading in the 150s or so, and got serious. I think during the Brood saga was when I really got into it. Yep. And then I had to go back and find some back issues and get caught up. But yeah, you've said that you didn't start reading X-Men until the Jim Lee days, is that right?
Yeah, really early 90s, regularly. I would say that Milestone X-Men number 1 by Lee mm-hmm. and Claremont, which everyone, 8 million people apparently own a copy of, which that's a little bit suspect, but neither here nor there.
I think 1 million people own 8 copies of it.
Yeah.
Or at least did at one time.
More accurate. Point being, it's still the highest selling comic of all time. So that was my kind of regular point of entry where I was like hooked on X-Men. Because right around that time, you would have, well, not that same year, it would be the following year, the X-Men animated series starting up. Of course, you also had the action figures from Toy Biz. Yep, that first line, I want to say, preceded the actual comic, X-Men Ejectiveless number 1.
Yeah.
Trading cards are out there too. So, I mean, there's a lot of other media.
Wizard Magazine was all about the X-Men back then. Yeah, it was everywhere. They did a great job of saturating the desire for more X-Men stuff in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yep. And then, as I've said before, my exposure to this run would have come in the mid-90s reading the Black and White Essentials volumes. Yeah. So had that alongside stuff like Operation Zero Tolerance. And, found my preference in the much, much older comics. They were just more exciting. There was more going on. Better writing, better action, just all around. I don't know that I would have stuck with comics just as a regular reader if I didn't have those back issues and access to those trades, especially as affordable as they were, to really buoy my interest in those lean years, because boy, the late 90s X-Men stuff, it was like all of the goodwill they had built up and the readership that they had gained, it feels like they were deliberately trying to squander it, which I know they weren't, but
it was a complicated time with all the Onslaught stuff. There was editorial driven things,
which I was fine for, largely. You know.
And I loved Age of Apocalypse, but
that
was a finite thing, but it was different enough that they could tell some fresh stories. I felt a lot of times there was a lot of rehashing going on. You know, this worked once, let's do it again. Whereas this Byrne Claremont run, they're cutting new territory. You know, they're going through new ground and telling stories that have never been told before. So
there was also a lot of stalling, a lot of filler, especially coming off the heels of Onslaught, where you could tell they just started spinning their wheels like, what's going to be our next hit? What do we do next?
Yeah.
And they didn't really have an immediate answer for that. And this run is quite the opposite. It is all killer. And wow, we're closing in on the conclusion here of the Dark Phoenix saga. Hard to believe.
We certainly are. There's more Byrne Claremont X-Men to come after that, specifically.
A little bit. Yep.
One very notorious or well-loved storyline. But we will kind of keep going here through Jean Grey's saga. We're going to hit up issue 136, and this is called Child of Light and Darkness. This is one where that title has stuck with me quite a bit. You have the classic cover, and some people have said this is a legacy cover or an homage cover to a Jack Kirby Thor, where Odin is carrying Thor, or Thor is carrying Odin. I don't have the image with me, but I can visualize it. I think it's Odin carrying Thor. And, of course, Crisis on Infinite Earths in a few years from here did a similar cover with George Perez drawing Superman carrying Supergirl, who died in that issue. Spoiler alert to a 35-year-old comic.
You'll also see it. Frank Miller in his Daredevil run did an homage to this as well, with Daredevil cradling his dead father. This is kind of a cool inversion of what the original inspiration behind this was, which is Michelangelo's Pietà, the great Renaissance sculpture of Christ being cradled by the Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
Very directly lifted and seen in The Life and Death of Captain Marvel, cover of that, which great graphic novel that the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Greg and Nick, just recently covered.
And it is also available on Marvel Unlimited.
Absolutely. Yes, and on Place to Be Nation Pop.
Oh, well, that podcast is, but the episode, the graphic novel you can read on there. Jim Starlin's finest work, yes. I have a physical copy that's, I don't know if it's worth anything, but it's old, you know. And I did love the format of the old Marvel graphic novels. I had a few of them. I have...
Did I call it The Life and Death of Captain Marvel? The graphic novel itself is called The Death of Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
The trade, there is a trade, which I have called The Life and Death of Captain Marvel, includes that graphic novel and some issues leading up to it.
Okay.
So pretty good package.
How he got the cancer?
Yeah, I believe that's in there. Some of the Thanos stuff as well. Gosh, it's been a few years. They need to do... Have they ever done an omnibus of, like, the entire Starlin...
Boy, that you would think so. And I think things with Starlin have been kind of... Marvel and Starlin relationship has not been tremendous. But, you know, somebody would want to make some money on that.
You'd think this is the year to do it if you want to capitalize on that.
Yeah, well, we don't want to confuse people because there's a lot of Captain Marvels running around there.
This is true. Yeah.
That could lead to questions, and then questions would lead to people talking to each other about them or researching them for themselves on Wikipedia. So
and throwing around terms like stolen valor.
Oh God. Yep. Yep, there it is. Although
fictional characters and their gender and fictional ranks and just what a world.
Yeah, and I have been maybe I don't know if I've been I think I'm just paying attention to what I say online about things like that. I mean, just to say, well, I'm not a big fan of rebranding characters. I'd rather see a if we're going to have a minority character or a representative character, let's create a new one and tell an awesome story from that. But you know, I don't, I'm of two minds of it. When a new character is presented, but using costume and iconography and story elements from an established character, it doesn't take away the stories you loved about that character, you know?
And I just look at it as, I would agree, in a perfect world, the thing to do is just, hey, give us new character after new character after new character. When you want to, let's say, diversify your lineup, which is a very worthwhile thing to do to better reflect, you know, the world that we live in. But you sort of have to be cognizant of the economic realities. And I think anytime someone, especially like a longtime comics reader, wants to employ that argument of, oh, we're going to change an old character, make a new one, like, you know, you're arguing in bad faith, because the idea is you want to get eyes on this character. You want to get dollar signs behind them, and new characters just don't sell. I don't care who they are, what race, nationality, gender, whatever. New characters just are a really hard sell, period. So, yeah, I don't know. You have to kind of look at it in terms of the greater good and,
well, half of yourself, it is,
check your privilege, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Half of it is the Marvel and DC too. They won't let characters stay dead.
True. You
know, they open the door for these characters to come through, and okay, here's the new Captain, you know who, or whatever. And, well, it's not working out or selling as well, so we need to resurrect. No, you need to commit fully and let this play out. You're going to survive. Marvel and DC are always going to be around in some way, shape, or form.
I know. And that's the part of me that's like, oh God, I hate legacy characters. Just because, again, now talking about the economic, you're also talking about the nostalgic realities of the way these things work. And I know, Russell Sellers and I are on probably opposite sides of that argument, but I just, anytime there's a legacy character, I'm like, well, let's start counting the days. It's just, I hate to be that way, but this is, again, the world we live in.
Cool. Well, that has nothing to do with X-Men 136.
No. Great talk.
It was a great talk, and it was an actual conversation, and
It was about comics.
I don't know if this is the first episode we've ever had of Conversation Hangover.
Now we're getting some.
We had a nice group chat last night, and I was drinking wine, and you were having, what were you having last night?
I was having some Gentleman Jack, and you had box wine night, which I did. Was thrilled with.
Trader Joe's box wine night. There's something about it, man. It's on a Friday night.
Yeah, well, Trader Joe's. Hell yeah.
Quality. So we are diving back in to Uncanny X-Men 136. When last we left our X-Men, Dark Phoenix had just gone through the galaxy, roasted a planet of broccoli people, and she's coming back to Earth, and she's hungry.
That's right.
We
did terrible things to the Dabari broccoli people. I think we mischaracterized them.
I regret nothing.
For comedic purposes. But, from what we presented, I won't say they got what they deserved, but can it be counted as a surprise, really?
Yes, certainly. I mean, we weren't expecting that to happen, but we've talked about the editorial lack of oversight that led it to happen, and then the consequences of such, you know, a shooter was playing golf that day or something.
Yeah. Somehow there was some miscommunication in that
shooter and Salakrup, I believe.
Yeah. Baton between editors. And it was one of those, it seemed like a game of telephone where one person said this to another person, said this to another person. And along the way, I guess the ball got dropped, or the baton got dropped, to stay within our analogy. And, something got approved that perhaps would not have been approved if Shooter himself had put eyes on it. Or who knows, maybe he just had a brain fart and didn't realize. Because, I mean, that happens too, you know, when your boss is just kind of out to lunch and mentally is like, yeah, okay, cool, looks good, signs off, and then later, I didn't know you were going to do this. It's just, okay.
Yeah, and Vernon Claremont had earned a lot of goodwill, like the sales numbers had absolutely turned around on the book by this point. So, yeah, but the story played out a different way because of that, and we'll talk about that when we get to Dark Phoenix, The Untold Story. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yep.
I wondered if we would be covering that.
I think we're going to have to talk about that in between issues 137 and 138, because it was an important part of my childhood, too.
Yep. And so we'll get to that.
I have a copy of that comic signed by Stan Lee and John Byrne, of all people.
No kidding.
Pretty interesting. Stan Lee had nothing to do with
I guess
Stan Lee
presents.
Right? Yep, Stan Lee presents. So he'll sign anything. Digging into 136, we have an all-time classic splash page by John Byrne, where Dark Phoenix, the Phoenix Effect, has its talons around, it looks like a sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful image here. And this is one of those things where...
They reuse it a lot, yeah.
Yeah, well, and you lose a lot on reading this in a black and white format. Mm. You know what I mean? We probably... As you know, most people who talk about comics and review comics don't give enough credit to the colorist here, who is Glynis Wayne, married to Lynn Wayne, I believe.
Absolutely.
And
formerly Glynis Oliver, right?
Right. Yeah. Yep. I mean, the colors here just really sell this as much as, you know, Burns pencils. Which, don't get me wrong, are tremendous in any presentation, but here it's just really breathtaking.
And, you know, we don't talk about the inks all that often. These issues have all been inked by Terry Austin, and probably the premier inker for Byrne, preferred by many people to even Byrne inking his own stuff. So Austin, Byrne, I forget to mention that, but the inks have an important role in the contrasts and telling the story a certain way. So making sure all the detailed art comes through and helps up set up the coloring. So look at the font used for this too. Kind of a Lord of the Rings type thing.
Yeah. Yep. Kind of that epic myth being evoked here.
So our splash page, we had left with Lalandra's, the Shi'ar had a ship that Phoenix disabled, or did she outright destroy it?
Yeah, it was like a some kind of scout ship that witnessed her destruction of the Dabari star system. So is this one of those, it's a forest moon, not a planet. It's a star system, not a planet.
Right.
They were called the Dabari people. We know this. And they witnessed this great destruction, and then the Phoenix itself relay that back to Lalandra, who recognizes and says, you know, this is a day that I had come to fear, that you know, this being of immense, tremendous power that has helped us in the past is now going to be potentially our enemy, and they're trying to decide what to do about this.
Yeah, they really kind of recap. This is a recap of last issue, where she ages a star, basically.
Right.
Instead of, we thought she just sucked its power out, and maybe she did, but they're saying that by her draining the star, it advanced to supernova, blew up the Dabari and the planets. Kind of a motley crew of aliens here. Byrne gets to draw. You do see Gladiator. I guess it's the Shi'ar Grand Council, but they're not all Shi'ar. They're not all bird people. You get some interesting aliens in there.
Yeah, well, we understand the Shi'ar are a multi-galactic spanning empire, so kind of makes some sense that they'd have different alien beings represented here. We have the Chancellor Araki. Is that what his name is?
Yes. Yep. And kind of the sage old man, but also Gladiator, who we're going to talk about a lot in the next couple issues. Leader of the I believe the, not the gladiators, the Shi'ar gladiators.
The Imperial Guard.
The Imperial Guard team based on the Legion of Superheroes. So yep. We'll see lots of those guys coming up here. But for now, again, lots of recap going on. Lalandra talks about Phoenix's origin, and she's not a good Phoenix anymore. She's an evil creature that will stop, will consume the entire universe if we don't stop her. We must...
A dark Phoenix, if you will.
Yeah. If the universe is to survive, Phoenix must be destroyed. Phoenix must die. Must die. Mm. Must die. This Phoenix must die. So, that's a Jesus Christ Superstar reference. We get Jimmy Carter on page 2.
Yes.
Yes. Very special episode of Conversation Hangover here. We have Jarvis the Butler and talking to Jimmy Carter, and I believe...
in his bathroom.
Yeah, and it's phonetic Jimmy Carter.
Very phonetic. All right, should we try to do this?
I think you should do it, because if I did it, it would end up sounding like Foghorn Leghorn, which we don't want.
Well, it might be kind of funnier, but let me give it a shot here. So we've got Jimmy Carter in his bathrobe. Looks like he's flanked by, is that Gyrich behind
him? It's Gyrich, but he doesn't have his red hair. And then I don't know who's on the video screen behind him. Is that Corbeau? It might be Corbeau.
Yeah, I think that's Super Dr. Astronaut, yep, Peter Corbeau.
So.
So he's having a – President Carter is having a video conference with Jarvis the Butler and says to him, "Mr. Jarvis, I understood that an Avenger was always supposed to be on monitor duty. I've been calling for some time without response. An energy force of unknown origins, but considerable power, is approaching Earth." I don't know if that was Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton or Foghorn Leghorn.
No. Well, there's one more on the bottom.
Yes. "If this is some extraterrestrial attack, I want the Avengers ready to deal with it."
Okay, now say, "Jenny was my best good friend."
"Jenny was my best good friend." All right,
there we go.
Yeah, there we go.
I think that's what we put our fingers on it. Tim doing Jimmy Carter is Forrest Gump.
It's
so
Forrest Gump, okay.
But yeah, Claremont wrote it out in Carter's accent. And this is calendar year.
Those emphasis, that was all there in the text itself, in the script.
Yep. You were not adding anything. I mean, you were absolutely adding your wonderful performance to it, but... you were not adding the emphasis was implied by Claremont. So, and we're spending too much time on it, but it's glorious. It's wonderful. This is the kind of thing that tickles me.
Yep.
And
Jarvis is taken aback too.
Yeah. And keep in mind, I always, you know, you always assume Reagan was the U.S. president in the '80s, but this is calendar year 1980. And the election wasn't until November of 80 that, Reagan beat Carter, so inauguration wasn't until January of 1981.
Yeah, this comic has a August 1980 cover date, so you figure it's published in like June,
late spring. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Late cover dates worked.
So lame duck. Well, not quite lame duck yet. Soon to be lame duck Carter, and he was not a very popular president. At this time, when I recall, I mean, people talking about gas prices, the gas crisis, and Iran. Hostage situation. But here he is.
He's also chastising us for the malaise we've been in our hungover stupor today.
Yes. Sober up, gentlemen.
You've got a lot of work. Okay.
Yeah. And so our friend Jarvis, the Avengers butler, is taken aback. Master Beast was supposed to be on monitor duty, but he's gone. Where'd you go, Beast? Where could he have gone? Dun, dun, dun. Transition to the X-Mansion and Beast. Well, no?
We do transition, but I'm remembering that Beast was on monitor duty. Yeah, last issue, he abandoned his post when he realized his friends, his former teammates, were in danger.
They were falling from the sky.
They were literally falling from the sky, and he rushed to Central Park, which was the site of their first battle, very one-sided, lopsided battle against Dark Phoenix.
Oh, my stars and garters, everybody's falling. I'm going to catch them with my feet.
Yeah. So he did what he could there, and now they have reconvened back at the mansion.
Furry Blue Beast. Classic character. Yes, they're back at the mansion and working on some tech. I guess he's working on the plane. What is going on? Hank, the Beast, is working on your basic mnemonic scrambler. We just talked about Johnny Mnemonic last night. What a callback. Slap this on Phoenix's head. She shouldn't be able to think a coherent thought. So,
much like anyone watching Johnny Mnemonic.
Henry Rollins as a professor. That was great casting.
Oh, my Lord.
That's about all I remember about that film.
Keanu Reeves as an actor.
Yeah, pre-Matrix. Pre-Matrix Keanu was not a pretty sight. And he single-handedly derailed one of my favorite films, Coppola's Dracula, or Bram Stoker's Dracula, directed by Coppola. I love that movie, and then...
Yeah. He had to be...
Keanu as Jonathan, I can't even think of the character right now. Harkness, yeah, takes me out of it every time. Bad. I'm going to put a stake through you, dude. Gary Oldman, wonderful film. All right, so Cyclops is still bummed out here, but yeah, Beast has created this device that should scramble the brains of Phoenix, or at least the human host of Phoenix. So we'll see if this works. Cyclops is very, very upset.
He's trying to keep it together, and this is pretty much what Cyclops does. He's throwing himself into his work. That's how his skills are best deployed, and really is going to be your ideal use of Cyclops in a situation like this, because if he starts dwelling on the ramifications and the implications here, then we're going to have a real mess on our hands. Great transitional scene here where he's swapping out his visor for his just everyday civilian ruby quartz glasses, and we get a quick recap. I don't know why he's thinking to himself things that he already knows, but again, for the benefit of the readers.
Yeah, the conceit of comics, you know, we're told that this is how these situations work. I'm not vulnerable when I'm blasting. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of unnecessary dialogue. But then we get back to the story. Aurora wants to comfort him, but he is stoic and he's burying it. And just beautifully drawn stuff. Everybody's dealing with it the way they want to or the way they need to.
I will say this kind of works. The thought balloons. I mean, I kind of ridiculed the expository nature of it there, but he's trying to think about anything but Jean right here. And Storm, who is, you know, there's this great image of her looking upon him like, you know, is he okay here? Is he going to make it through this?
And she's wanting to, always empathetic, you know.
Just the most empathetic member of the team, wanting to reach out, comfort him in some way, which he recognizes, he knows, but he's just, you know, not letting it show at all, just pushing through. And so you get that great contrast between them.
So kind of the brainy Avenger or brainy X-Men, and I won't even say they're all brainy, but the leadership of X-Men and the
future leadership.
Yeah. And then X-Men. And then in the Danger Room, the more physical members are working out. Why are they doing that? Are they dealing with it, or they're just thinking we need to be sharp for whatever this impossibly powerful entity throws at us, spinning blades, whatever.
Perhaps just reflecting on the futility of the situation, they can't really make much of a contribution here, so why not take out some aggression on the Danger Room? Plus, it gives us a good Danger Room scene, which is always welcome.
Always welcome.
Any X-Men comic.
Yep. Yeah, one of the I don't want to say cliches. One of the tropes of X-Men comics are the Danger Room workouts. We don't have Professor X, he's in space with Lilandra right now. So Cyclops is kind of it. And if Cyclops is distracted or dealing with something else, everybody else has they go off into their different directions here. Colossus kind of mentions that where the brains are not the X-Men, there's nothing we can do to help. So this is what we're doing. He's saying what I'm thinking. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So on the same page there. Meanwhile, Dark Phoenix has returned to Earth. She is approaching her childhood home, in fact. Annandale on Hudson, New York.
Okay.
Described as a sleepy little college hamlet some 50 miles northwest of the X-Men's mansion, which we know is in
Westchester County, yes.
Mm-hmm. Upstate New York.
Right. So this is even more north.
Mm-hmm.
So northwest. I'm trying to visualize. My New York geography is terrible.
Yeah.
By the way.
So in any case, not a place that, I mean, I've been to upstate New York, Rochester, but
New Rochelle.
Yeah. Geographically, I don't know exactly where that would be in relation to these places, but this is where she grew up. This is where her parents still reside. Some kind of cool architecture here that Byrne gets to cut loose on. I mean, it's a pretty mundane setting and scene. It's supposed to be. But
kind of looks like the house from Family Ties. I don't know if you've ever seen Family Ties, mm-hmm. but you know, when she enters her house, it kind of looks like that, or it looks like what, you know, you expect a house of that time, small TV, consoles, art, and you know, her retired parents are living there. Sarah is not living there. We were talking about Sarah Gray recently. Well.
Is she though?
Oh, well, we'll find out. I'm not there yet.
She will be making an appearance. I know that much.
Okay. So. Yeah, I believe she does, at least in the funeral. Well, whoops, we're getting ahead of ourselves right now.
Uh-oh.
I'm sure appreciating the artwork here and yes. just beautifully. And I think you actually noticed some of the Terry Austin trademarks here, you know, the cross-hatching and just beautiful faces.
I am getting a dispatch from the Real Gentleman of Leisure.com blog. Summary of this issue states that according to John Byrne, he modeled the gray home after the house from Bewitched. No source for that, but I will take their word for it.
Were you a fan of Bewitched?
Not really. I mean, it was on that I would see.
I'm dropping things. Wrong. Pardon me. Sorry about that.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, look out. Bewitched. Yeah, it was on syndication. Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I always kind of put those hand in hand.
Right, right. I would see it on Nick at Night, but I can't say they were favorites.
So Bewitched has, I mean, it was a show I watched a lot, and, you know, you had the two different Darrens. Do you remember that aspect?
I do, yeah.
You had.
I didn't really care, but either way.
And
it was just one that it would come on. I can't remember if it was before or after Get Smart, but I did enjoy Get Smart as a kid.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents, they showed that as well.
I don't think I was ever allowed to watch the Hitchcock stuff as a kid, but, you know, staying at grandma's, I would end up watching things like Get Smart and Lancelot Link. Did you ever get Lancelot Link?
No, we'll
talk about that. Imagine Get Smart done by chimpanzees, live action chimpanzees.
Oh,
you were not expecting that, were you?
No.
All right, someday we'll watch. Maybe we'll do conversation chimps.
Live, that'd be a riveting live watch, no doubt.
So, all right, good to know. And Jean is confronted by her father. Is her father a doctor?
I believe they do refer to him as Dr. Gray at points, but
yeah, nice
I don't know
house,
that he's
nice
an MD or a PhD. He might be an academic. I could not tell you.
Yeah. So she's in her Dark Phoenix regalia, but she has her Jean Grey font. So, you know, mm-hmm. she's not sporting the Phoenix effect, but she's still in her red costume. She didn't change that back. And I always think of the costume as kind of like projection of her. You know, she turned it from green to red, and then later things happen where the costume reflects her personality too. But yeah, there she is. There's
yes,
Jean's big sister. So why is Jean's big sister living here? How old is Jean Grey supposed to be at this point?
It's a great question.
136 issues in.
I think, you know what? I want to say I'm trying not to spoil anything.
Early 20s, right? Oh, no, yeah, we will get confirmation on it.
Canonical evidence of what her age is here coming up soon. And I believe she is 24. For some reason, I'm thinking either 24 or 26. So we'll say early to mid-20s. And this is her, yeah, older sister, who has children of her own. It's worth mentioning. They aren't going to show up in this story, and they actually won't show up for some time, I don't think.
But why would we ever revisit the Jean Grey family? Well, I'm getting ahead of myself again, too. So, but why is she at her parents' house? I don't think it matters other than Claremont wanted there to be this conflict in Jean to deal with this.
Yeah, well, we don't see Sarah's husband, so maybe there's some kind of they had a falling out divorce situation. I'm going to stay with my mother.
Yeah, maybe Sarah's husband wouldn't let her go to WrestleMania, and goes to her mom's. It's unknown why Sarah Gray would be staying as an sister older than Jean. Jean, who's 24, so you know maybe there's a falling out or. She's staying with them so that she can go shopping in the city tomorrow. There we go.
Could be.
All right, I win a no prize. Give me a no prize.
Yeah, I like it.
But meanwhile, Jean's just going crazy because she's being bombarded by the emotions. You know, all of the mental condition of her family is an open book to Jean with her enhanced powers and. You know, she was always telekinetic, but now she's telepathic and really, really telepathic, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and as we know, emotions are like an aphrodisiac for the Phoenix, just sort of feeding and wanting more and just being driven to great extremes by this experience of emotion. And I'm being somewhat... We've been somewhat elliptical in how we talk about the Phoenix, and that's for a good reason. And
you know, it will be talked about eventually.
It will be clarified eventually, yeah.
Very eventually. Or no, not eventually, but I'm trying to think very, very soon. So
Yeah,
all these emotions are seeing her transform, making her transform before our very eyes into a different person, a different human. It is established that Sarah has two kids here. And they are talking about it. But yeah, she's power incarnate. She holds the fate of the universe in her hands, or at least in her thought balloons. And now she kind of wigs out in front of her family.
I know. Look at the shift here, just in her facial expression, her features. I think in the last episode, compared it to The Exorcist, you know, Linda Blair. And I'm still getting that here. It's just kind of emblazoned on my mind.
Yeah.
But... I mean, wow, just powerful stuff.
I had a girlfriend like that. You know, she would, everything would be fine. And then what you say one thing, boom, she's turning your plants into crystal, you know,
take a shot.
Yes. That's Todd Weber drinking game. So yeah, she does it in front of her family. And we do have Dark Phoenix font again. And,
well, and that was a good segue too, because she does turn a plant into a crystal here, to their shock and dismay, which I mean, she's transmuting matter. This is, I mean, this is kind of, we saw it in the previous issue when she transforms a random tree in the park that's been uprooted into solid gold. And you know, the costume changes that she's just making at will. I mean, this is,
and not even thinking about it, not even straining.
There's telepathy, there's telekinesis, and there's this. I mean, she is far beyond any conventional definitions or limits on these powers.
And she becomes unrecognizable, not physically to the Gray family, but you're not my daughter, you're not mine, any part of me. I deny you, I cast you out. You know, they're to draw even more exorcist allusions. There it is, you know, literally, I cast out you, demon.
Get a little extra there.
But Jean is still at war inside her. You know, you have two different voices. You have the Jean voice, dad, no, please, and the thought balloons, and then, but Phoenix, Dark Phoenix speaks, watch your tone with me, you dance with death and worse, and then the X-Men show up to rescue her.
We see her literally at conflict with herself, which I don't think is something we've seen prior to this.
No,
I mean, she would flip modes and go from Phoenix to Dark Phoenix, but she's just having this internal struggle now, you know, with the two egos, these two personalities essentially just colliding and grappling for control.
Yeah, and it's kind of like when she was having the hallucinations that Mastermind put into her, mm-hmm. you know, where she would be conscious of it, but she couldn't do anything about it. Same thing here. She's thinking things, but the Phoenix Force is the dominant personality. And you know, she does leave because she's got to investigate this fog that Storm has brought upon her. They've tracked her down 50 miles or so away. And she's captured, not even captured, but ambushed by Nightcrawler, who teleports and puts on the MacGuffin onto her head.
the mnemonic, easy for me to say,
yeah.
Mnemonic Scrambler, which is sort of this fancy high-tech headband-looking thing.
Just specifically created this episode or issue to give us, the, you know, break down even more of the plot of Jean's at conflict. This is the only way the X-Men can kind of assume they can help her, but it's for her own good. You know, this is because they all love her and they want her to be well and they want the universe to survive. This is the halfway point of the issue, page 9.
Okay.
So it's a good time to take a break. So we hope you will stay with us when we return on the other half. And thank you for listening to a very special episode of Conversation Comics. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to Place to Be Nation Pop Network. This is Conversation Comics. I'm Todd Weber, joined by Tim Capel as usual. This is part 8 of our John Byrne, Chris Claremont X-Men overview, in-depth look at the Dark Phoenix saga and other great storylines of this time. But did you know that we had a busy week on the pop feed? There was a little something for everyone. Did you know that Steve Williams and Kelly were joined by Jason Sherman on the latest songs with Friends? Tim.
I did, yes.
Tim, you knew that, yes?
Because I listened to it, because I am a subscriber of Place to Be Nation Pop, where you can find this and so many other great shows.
Yes, all you have to do is get a podcast app on your cellular telephone device, and you may subscribe to feeds, and they will give you totally free content. It is amazing. So they talked about Bush on this show. Are we talking the presidents?
No, we were talking the alternative rock band from the 1990s. Although their song selection was not from their heyday. It was a more recent song from Bush.
Obscure Bush. So not mainstream Bush. Well, there were other shows as well. Of course, there's the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and they were starting the Shazam month. They had a Long Book Hunters episode where they talked about the Monster Society of Evil by Jeff Smith. And recently, they did a full-length, or not a full-length, but a half of their show is devoted to the new Shazam film, which Tim has not seen, and neither have I. Have you seen it?
No, I have not. I'll probably see that one once it goes to streaming.
Yeah, I have not seen it, but I want to see it because I understand it's fairly well received and the kiddies will love it. There was also The Essential Jim Ross, which was one of the highest downloaded episodes in Place to Be Nation pop history, believe it or not, is the Hard Traveling Fanboys third anniversary spectacular. Well, not spectacular, but spectacularly compiled edition of Jim Ross singing karaoke songs. We had an NBA playoff preview from Adam and Andrew on the NBA Team podcast, Marvel Age Crew. Hey, that's us, along with Nick and Russell. We talked about 1970. 1970 what? 1970 Marvel Comics. Fantastic Four, Amazing Spider-Man, The Avengers, and so on. What was your favorite part of that episode?
Probably closing out that Silver Age run of X-Men.
Neil Adams.
I mean, spot the you know, cliche here. I mean, me talking X-Men, but I mean, whether it's Bronze Age, Silver Age, Modern Age, Age, whatever, I'm always down for some X-Men talk, and I thought that produced some good discussion, those last three issues that we were able to cover from the Silver Age, just being different in their own, each different in their own way. So, yeah, fun episode.
Very good. Yeah, it was. It's been a lot of fun being exposed to older Marvel stuff that I didn't know much about. We had another episode of Talkin' Pop. You and Jennifer were joined by Glenn Butler. How was that?
That's right. That was a lot of fun. Glenn was in the hot and high question mark. Yes, high.
Yeah,
seat.
I'm certain Glenn was in the high seat. No doubt. You know that guy.
Oh, yeah. Always got to have the seat higher than the rest of us. Oh. No, it was a lovely talk, as they all are, with Glenn, who is one of my longtime close personal great friends. I know I botched that, but that's okay.
It's good.
Yeah, the one person within our community, our circle of friends, who can vouch for me being a real person. He's been in my house. We've hung out. He'll tell you I'm not just a voice coming from the machine. I mean, he might tell you that, but he'd be lying.
So, I still haven't listened, but I think I knew that on some level that you had met, but because you had said things about Glenn's secret Republican past that I didn't know.
Right. We actually did not delve into that on the episode, which kind of surprised me, but it went in other places that I did not necessarily expect.
Okay.
But welcome to Talkin' Pop.
Yeah, that you never know what you're going to get with Talkin' Pop. It's a box of chocolates. There was also Geek and Sassy, the Sassy Awards, the Sassies. There it is. That was a fun episode, and some of my picks won. How about you? Were you able to get a ballot in?
Now, this I'm behind on. I do need to pull up the latest Geek and Sassy to get with the Sassy Awards. It's one of those, like, I want to listen to it in one go, not have a bunch of interruptions as I do with most podcasts, and I just haven't been able to do it yet. So.
Yeah.
That's the one I'm behind on right now that I'm kicking myself for a little bit.
It was a relatively quick listen for Geek and Sassy, but still a lot of fun. And you could definitely tell that they were able to get a wide variety of voters. You know, I could tell some very specific JT Rosero votes that came through. So that was interesting. Looking Forward, Looking Back, hosted by Andy Atherton, is doing a summer movie wager. Based on how well you think you can predict this movie, summer movie box office lineup will go, and I botched that terribly. But you're going to predict what you think they're going to do. Pick 10, 1 through 10, in order of how you think they'll finish. Obviously, number one will be Curious George, the return of the man in the yellow hat. No, okay. We know.
You say that, but we will also, just for shits and grins, although actually I believe it is part of the contest, we'll be giving our picks for the biggest box office bust of the summer.
Ah, okay.
Well, I need to get this in.
Is Hellboy, the new Hellboy, eligible for that?
I don't know if that's on the list.
All right. It seems like that one's crap to the bed.
Yeah, I have the list, but I need to get that into to Andy and spend some time with it, because I will be on that that panel on looking forward, looking
good.
Back.
Okay,
and
for that day.
Participating in this contest, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Well, if you...
It's open to listeners as well.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're out there in listener land and you actually win, you prognosticate successfully the 1 through 10, you get to guest star on a future episode of Laugh-In Theater and create an alternative commentary track, such as I did for Swingers and Tim, you did for a movie that is to be publicly revealed later.
Okay. I will say then.
All right.
Yeah, coming up soon.
But yes, it is coming up soon here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Hey, we have another feed on Place to Be Nation. It's the wrestling feed. Tim, take it away.
Yeah, so this is an altogether different podcast feed. This is Place to Be Nation Wrestling. So if you're subscribed to Pop and you like wrestling, subscribe as well to Place to Be Nation Wrestling, where we have Nate Milton and his crew breaking down WrestleMania 35. That was on a special edition of Chain Reaction.
Who's Nate Milton? Is he the former WWE wrestler, The Godfather?
that's what I've been told. That's the hearsay, but some would have you believe that. Yes,
Roger believed that for a long time.
It's not for me to say, quite frankly. There was also a Place to Be Nation reaction show to WrestleMania 35. So after each pay per view, Chris and Devin break down same day / overnight, given the length of these pay-per-views these days, but basically immediate impressions from the pay-per-view. So they did that for WrestleMania 35, kept you up into the early hours of the morning, I guess, getting that ready, right?
I'm not complaining. I did my duty, and I helped the feed, and we were able to get it up. And I would like to think that this was the first WrestleMania reaction pod that hit the internet after WrestleMania 35. After WrestleMania 35,
I was going to say I think it would be hard to dispute that, because Chris and Devin, I mean, turned it around fast.
Yes,
is so. Kudos to everybody involved in making that happen when it did. I think give ourselves not to toot our own horn, but toot. Did you notice how I totally abandoned what I was going to say?
That's all right. Yeah. Hey, did
Made
you know
it more wrestling appropriate?
Yeah. I described placetobenation.com to somebody. Say it's a little bit of everything. It's comics and movies and everything, but mostly wrestling. So yeah. That was my hashtag for a while. But mostly wrestling.
I have described it as, how Grantland was centered around sports but had other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of like Grantland, but instead of sports as the centerpiece, wrestling, but with other stuff.
Yeah, and now it's the Ringer. Grantland essentially became the Ringer.
Well, this was back in the early days.
I know. ESPN paid for Grantland, and I was so happy because Place to Be Nation lasted longer than Grantland, even though it wasn't a competition, But the Ringer is great. You want to talk about something that has a little bit of something for everyone. There's really good everything on The Ringer. And in fact, I've been checking in with them for Game of Thrones coverage lately. So.
Ah, excellent. Well, one place you will not find the Game of Thrones coverage is on the very excellent Wrestling War Zone, Place to Be Nation Wrestling. That is with JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. They are finishing off the year of 1995, discussing WCW Starrcade of that year. So something pretty near and dear to my heart, and they're coming up on a year, 1996, that is kind of lit, I feel like, and Wrestling War Zone, I feel like, is going to reflect that. So
yeah, 1996, kind of everything was cranked up a notch, both in WWF and WCW.
Yep. Yep. Sneaky good year for WCW, as I've said many times.
Even pre-NWO.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. We also are continuing our dip into where the big boys play from the archives, from the vault. That's with Chad Campbell and Parv. They are looking at Starrcade 1987 on that show.
So we are. We have a lot of WCW shows here.
We do.
That's good.
We do. We also have another one that is not mentioned because we are between episodes right now. But yeah, there's another WCW show on Place We Nation Wrestling. It's called Talking WCW. Fine hosts. Owe it to yourself. Check it out. But
I've heard good things.
Yeah, one of the hosts of Talking WCW, Greg Phillips, with Nick Duke. They are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. They have a wrestling gig as well. It is called What If Wrestling. Their second episode was examining a world where CM Punk does not leave the WWE in 2014, as he so infamously did. That's a real quick listen. Good, good show. What If Wrestling, about 35 or so minutes of your time, but really fast-paced, really analytical. They really put their thinking caps on and kind of crack open these hypothetical scenarios.
Yes, it's shorter listen than this live read, in fact.
Probably is.
But that's okay. Because that's one of the reasons you're checking out our show is because we do a live read like no other. Except for maybe the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Well, except for maybe the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And that's going to do it for Place to Be Nation Wrestling.
Yep. Check out placetobenation.com for daily updated content, whether it's podcasts, whether it's articles. There's always something new on there. Be sure to click our Amazon link and do your shopping through there. So, Nightcrawler teleported on top of Jean Grey. We're on page 10.
Yep. Continue. Back to live action.
Yep. We resume. Phoenix is continuing to be split between the thoughts of Gene and the words of Phoenix, and different personalities thinking different things or presenting different things. She throws Nightcrawler off, but he was able to put the mnemonic headband on her successfully. Yep. And
that's giving her some problems. She's struggling, and the more she fights it, the worse it is for her, as Colossus is trying to explain, and he's attempting to corral her, but she is still really beyond his ability to contain. So
yeah, she kind of goes through them one by one briefly.
Yep.
Finally taking on Storm, besting her. A beautiful page there with the Storm Jean Grey battle one-on-one, large panels, just well-drawn, beautiful action.
And Storm is trying to appeal to her humanity. Mm-hmm. She's not really, I mean, yeah, she's summoned some pretty violent weather here, but she's not offensively going at Phoenix like she could. Saying, you know, in the name of the love we share, let us help you. And Jean rebuffs that.
Yeah, just throws her out. In the name of the love we shared, I'll weep over your grave. That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great writing.
There's so many great just rejoinders here.
Yeah, characters are
dialogue.
Yep, the characters are truly written to, you know, that they're saying things they would say. You hear their voices as you read their dialogue. And Beast, temper, Carrot Top. I mean, Beast is known her longer than anybody here other than Cyclops. And even then, it's like a matter of days difference. They know these guys go way, way back. But she is short circuiting the diadem, as they call it, the headband. Finally, yeah. Wolverine, you know, and Nightcrawler get back into it. Wolverine tackles her, gives her a spear. And takes her into the ocean, into the lake, local lake.
That is kind of some textbook Wolverine there. The tackle, often as the precursor to a berserker rage. But here he is firmly in control, deciding he's going to do what must be done here, what the others cannot bring mm-hmm. themselves to do. Pops the claws.
And this is a big deal to me. You know, this
yeah.
is...
Oh, yeah.
They're about to go where you hope they wouldn't go. You know, he's going to kill her. He's going to... And she encourages him to do it. Do it because she knows what could happen if he doesn't.
Yes, and that's the ironic twist here. While she's kind of this almost feral creature, and he's got her pinned down, he says, "Forgive me, darling." Pops the claws, and then she has this moment of clarity. She knows what he's going to do, as you say, encourages it, and this is what breaks his resolve. You know, you get the impression he could have done it if not for this moment she had of, yep. you know, realization. And, oh, irony can be so ironic.
Finally. So she burns through the headband, tears it off. She reclaims, you know, Dark Phoenix is again in control, and throws Wolverine off, overloads the scrambler, places the X-Men in stasis, mm-hmm. and lets them hover. And it's kind of easy for her to do. She just, boom, neutralizes them immediately. Colossus is appealing to her and finally tries to talk to her. If there's anything human, remember who you were, what you meant to us, and we to you. And she's just, there's no going back. You know, yeah. she's making fun of them, making fun of the relationship they once had, you know, with little brother. But then finally Cyclops arrives on the scene, and this is where shit's about to get real.
Yeah, so this was kind of their ace in the hole. I mean, it looks like all hope is lost here. The mnemonic scrambler has failed, and they are outmatched in hilarious fashion, as MCU Nick Fury might put it. So now Cyclops is making his appearance, and this is sort of, it's really a Hail Mary is what it is. Like, this is, if this doesn't work, well, we're screwed anyway. So he's going to take a pass at it here. And she even says, "I was wondering when you'd show up, when you'd turn up."
Yeah. And, this really gets to the meat and potatoes of things. You know, this, are you here to fight? Here to talk? I'm not going to listen. You know, Byrne is drawing her very much more twisted and evil at this point. Scott is throwing all his cards on the table emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why hasn't she killed them yet?
Yeah. He calls her bluff. He says, you know, if we're really so, beneath you, then kill me. Just do it right now, if you can.
And for the first time, you start really seeing the conflict in the Dark Phoenix, and she's getting talked back here. You know, Scott has really connected with her, and she, is honest here. I'm hungry. But I love you too. And you know, she's feeling it. And finally, he stalls her long enough for Professor X to show up. But
yeah,
that wasn't what Scott wanted necessarily.
No.
Either.
And, you know, it sort of begs the question, was he getting through to her? It mm-hmm. sort of seemed like he was. And then it's kind of snatched back. And, you know, this is something we've circled around a lot in talking this story in particular, you know, the whole power of love and how love conquers all and this, that, and the other. And it's sort of, I mean, it's, let's face it, a little gee golly hokum, but well, it does speak to kind of the motivations here of the Phoenix. Like, love is kind of messy. It's kind of uncomfortable sometimes. It's not, you know, it's not what you want to binge on. You know, the Phoenix is very much about, like, instant gratification. And it wants to chow down on some McDonald's or some yes. Sonic. It's not looking for something wholesome.
I wish there was a Sonic within driving distance of me. I mean, as there is, there's one by I work in a suburb. I have to drive about a half hour commute 2 days a week. And there's one close to there, but it's not close enough that I can do a lunch break run there. So
yeah. I put away about 7 Dabari Star Systems the other day at Sonic. So I know how it is, man.
Oh, Sonic. Yeah, yep.
Especially in the state we're in.
So, yeah, during this conversation between Scott and Gene, you see a starship kind of sneak in. I didn't catch that the first time around.
Oh, yeah. Kind of subtle there.
Dun, dun, dun. You know? Are we to assume it's the X-Men starship? No, it's not. It's how Professor X arrived. He temporarily disables her, he being Professor X, and then Dark Phoenix takes over again and really lays out, you know, she pushes away Cyclops, and she really lays out Charles, destroys his wheelchair. Yeah.
And Cyclops is incensed here.
Yeah, he's very mad. I had this under control. Well, no, you didn't have it under control, but... You know, Professor X could have at least told them, given them warning, other than...
Yeah, well, worked with them instead of
right.
trying to, being the kind of paternalistic asshole that he's being here.
Has always been, will always
and has
be.
Always been, yes. Meddling old fool, she calls him.
Mm. Our mentor, quote unquote. Yeah, she's got some Charles issues. Well, Charles was in love with her, as we knew from X-Men 2. So... Callback, yeah.
Oof,
yeah. Hey, it happened. Grant Morrison
could have talked a lot about that. We could have forgotten about that if not.
I wouldn't want to.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's I blame Mark Waid for that. Actually,
he brought it up on a panel or something.
No, he brought it up during Onslaught.
Yeah.
The whole run up to that, it was God. It was so gross.
I believe it had been talked about in things like. Comic Buyer's Guide, fanzine, things like that, too. So it was
one of those weird did-you-know pieces of trivia. Mm-hmm. Ugh, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, we get that. And very much she has these issues with Charles Xavier. Let's keep in mind, he's the one who installed these psychic circuit breakers, as we call them, when she was a child to... keep her powers in check, quote unquote, for her own good.
Make her forget where he touched her.
Oh, well.
Sorry, I didn't do that. Not implying. Not implying that Dark Phoenix can be read as a lashing out against that. I don't know. I'm thinking about it differently,
well,
I suppose.
I kind of think I know where you're going with it, and it's that... I think there's two kind of potentially mutually exclusive readings of this story, right? And it's like, on the one hand, you could look at it and have this sort of misogynistic takeaway and look at it like, well, it was intended as a cautionary tale. Oh, this is what happens when you let a woman amass great power and unfettered freedom, and you know, this is what the sexual liberation has brought us, you know.
Yeah, she's Gloria Steinem here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Quickly told to shut up and burn herself out. Look, this is what happens, ladies. I'm telling you.
This is what's gonna happen.
Join me on the O'Reilly Factor later.
And there are parts of the text that
allegedly,
yes. It could be supported, that reading, if you want to go there. But I don't know. If we're being intellectually honest and we know the writing of Chris Claremont as we know it, I would say his intent was very much the opposite.
Yes. Yeah. Nobody created or developed female characters like Claremont did at this time. I mean, they outnumbered him. You know.
Exactly. He famously was on record as saying when he creates a new character, he asks himself, is there any reason why this character can't be a woman? Which, you know, credit to him. I don't think that's something that a lot of writers, especially in the late 70s, early 80s, that would have even been on their radar, right?
Right. No corporate mandate telling him to do so.
No, absolutely not. So, I mean, I think... at the end of the day, this is really kind of a feminist story. It's about empowerment and tragic sacrifice. I mean, Jean has lost control by this point that we've covered. I mean, yes, that's obvious, but and at great cost to the poor Dabari broccoli asparagus people. But this is only coming on the heels of like repeated manipulations and tamperings with her mind and her perceptions by, as we've said, Charles Xavier and, you know, Jason Wingard.
So we get a psi war here, basically. Mind versus mind.
We've had
a psi war before. Professor Xavier versus, or early version of him, versus the Shadow King, Amul Farouk,
right,
back in Egypt in X-Men 117, one of my first X-Men comics. Actually, probably the second new X-Men comic I ever read, because it was sold as a paperback book that had giant size X-Men number one and then Psy War as just like a sample of where the team was. And so, I remember that. Yep. And we get one-on-one.
With Jean fighting, or Phoenix,
yes,
against the White Queen.
Right.
Which was part of this storyline, which it's easy to forget. This has been like nine parts now.
Yes. Yeah, that was early on. Issues. No, it was not that far back, but...
No.
So, why don't you kind of describe what's going on here between... how is Xavier able to best her, and how is that explained here? Because you would think she's the most powerful thing in the universe, and... he is a feeble old man in a wheelchair.
Right. Well, I mean, it's been told to us and reinforced that Professor Xavier is the most powerful telepath at this point in the Marvel universe. I don't think that has been really canonically threatened. Again, we are still in 1980. I mean, it will change later, but he has tremendous power in his own right that we've never really seen him unleash his full potential.
Yeah, hasn't had to necessarily.
And yet, at the same time, it kind of makes clear that what happens in this Psy War, as we put it, essentially it's Phoenix going back in a corner, you know, being this great power being suppressed once again. It would not have been possible had Jean herself not allowed it.
So there's enough of her in there still to suppress the Dark Phoenix on some level.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a pretty clever and important distinction. Like, this is not just... again, speaks to that initial reading of, oh, this is a cautionary tale. Well, it's not really, because it's saying Jean has agency here. She is actually the one in control, and the tragedy of it is she's kind of being complicit now in her own repression, but in a way that is, you know, making a sacrifice for the love of her friends, her family, the entire world. So it's kind of this great little commentary on the human condition, just the things that we do for love and, you know, how we put aside our own selfish interest. I mean, she could have the world. Look at the power. We've seen her wield just so effortlessly. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot to get into, potentially a lot to unpack, but that was sort of my takeaway.
Yeah, and it's revealed after she collapses and is stripped bare that she had helped. Charles reveals that in his thought balloons. We don't see that during the fight, but, you know, that's the only way it went through.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that analysis, thinking about it. And, you know, hey, we could just walk away now. It's done. Dark Phoenix Saga is done. She's got
The crazy part of that is it's Jean making this pretty huge sacrifice before she makes an even bigger sacrifice that we're going to see.
She gave up her life a long time ago. You know, she sacrificed her life to save the X-Men on the shuttle. And, you know, or was it on the space station? It doesn't matter. And then,
yeah,
you know, Phoenix brought her back. Then she saved her, you know, she sacrificed herself again with the crystal. And so it's kind of a theme with her.
Yeah, a running theme. And here she has basically sacrificed the Phoenix, sacrificed her powers to save her friends, sort of closing the loop on that original story, how this all got set in motion, as you said, going back to the shuttle.
Yep, and they lived happily ever after. She senses Cyclops proposing to her mentally, which is funny.
Yeah, we get a proposal here.
Yeah. The Gray family arrives, and Dr. Gray, or Jean's dad, gives up his robe, puts her in it. Everything is fine. There's Angel. Hey, look, Angel's there. But we remember that Charles was actually with Angel in New Mexico, and that's who showed up in the middle of the X-Men Phoenix fight there. Everybody is...
There's a higher self exchange between Jean and Scott.
I like that. Good. Yeah, you know Jean's back for real there.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great little shorthand to reveal that to us. That's a great Claremontism. We're going to see that a lot.
It's just that they don't write characters like this anymore. As clearly defined, the voice is there, and it's a symbiosis between the art and the writing too.
Yeah, very much so. So, as you pointed out, she is naked. So Dr. Gray is, you know, I mean, this is his daughter. He does not want to see her in the nude here. Gives up his bathrobe. And as you said, all is well. They lived happily ever after. That concludes our coverage, right?
Right. Dark Phoenix Saga is over. And, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Tim, for joining me on this journey. Oh, wait.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Oh,
wait. The X-Men. There we go. That's what I was waiting for. The X-Men, all of them, including Beast and Angel. So pretty much the entire X-Men roster, except for Iceman. Where's Iceman? What's going on with him?
I think Claremont just hated Iceman.
Yeah.
Because why else do you bring back all of the originals
except for Iceman? There's no reason for him not to be there. He could have been,
right.
You know, they're in, I don't know if they're in Central Park or they're kind of outside of the Gray estate, but
I think so. Yeah.
You know, and there could have been reason for him.
I mean, there's no reason for Angel or Beast to be here. So when you think about it, I mean, why not just reunite the whole crew? It's like, nope, not gonna do it.
Well, I guess the reason is this is Jean's story, and these are, you do want to have, you know, the characters that you associate with the original X-Men together one last time, the gang.
And admittedly, Iceman is the one who has had the least depth and you know, exploration of his
would
character.
Contribute the least to it. So maybe it's a numbers game with where they're going to pair off next issue. But I'm ahead of myself. So the team is spirited away to where we don't know. They're gone.
Vanished.
Yep. And so we would assume, okay, everything's good. Maybe, but we also know that Lilandra was coming for Phoenix. So we have to assume that's what's happening. And in fact, we will get there because the issue ends with the Gray family going, you know, we'll never see them again, or maybe we'll never see them. We'll ever see them again. It's a cliffhanger, if you will.
Mm-hmm. What a cliffhanger. Yeah.
Yeah.
With just the,
gone through the ringer stinger. And now this.
Yep. Next issue, the end of an epic. It's a 35 page masterwork. Do you think we can handle it?
Well, I think I'm going to have to take the day off work is what I'm going to have to do.
I think I might have to as well. And that is titled The Fate of the Phoenix.
The Fate of the Phoenix. Phoenix Must Die. Actually, it doesn't say Phoenix Must Die yet. And I will just let you know that that's one of the greatest comics in the history of Marvel or DC. X-Men 137 is considered to be the gold standard of single-issue X-Men comics. It's with good reason. It's a wonderful, amazing story that I can't wait to talk with you about on the next episode of Conversation Comics. Tim, where can people find you?
People can find me on the Twitter at Cyke68. That is C-Y-K-E on your Twitter machine. we'll keep it to that for now. You can check out the other podcasts, the aforementioned podcasts, during the break that I appear on as well.
Anything else to say about X-Men 136?
No.
I derailed you with a closing. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. I think we said what we had to say here. I think it's a story that was kind of headed in one way, and then this cliffhanger is going to yank us in a totally different direction, and we're going to see how that plays out in this wrap up here.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, this was kind of coming either way. It's not like this was going to be the last issue, and then they had to extend it. It's just that what we were in for was vastly different from what we're going to get.
Yeah, yeah, we will absolutely.
You may have heard
of it. You may have heard of it. You may have seen the cover. We should also. I lost it. I lost my train. I did.
Oh, I lost my train.
That's okay. It's not your fault. It's not. Oh, yeah. The title of this one, Child of Light and Darkness. And that was what was going on in Jean's head. You know, you had the duality of Phoenix throughout. And ultimately, Jean wins temporarily or helps, you know, the Jean side. Helps Charles subdue her, and all is well, or so we thought.
Very much so.
Well, I don't have a clever sign-off like Nuff Said or Class Dismissed, so we'll just ask you to join us on Conversation Comics next time. Thank you for listening, and bye-bye.